Basically, there was an uprising, and the thing that distinguishes it from most other sort of uprisings and riots at that time was that the textile workers focused on the machines that were well, basically the main issue was that the machines were part of the whole process of the Industrial Revolution, in which skilled labourers were, were being displaced by machinery that could do the work a lot quicker. One machine could do the work of 10 men, sometimes more. So, the beginning of the whole mill system and all the horrors that of that system in terms of the hours and the conditions. So they were basically fighting that whole process, and they saw themselves as skilled labourers and were very proud of their craft, and saw no reason why they should be forced to be wage slaves in the new mills. So, in Yorkshire it was the woolen trade, and it was a group of workers called the croppers, who their job was to basically get a nice smooth finish on the woolen cloth that was being produced in the by the weavers. So a very skilled job, requiring a lot of dexterity and also strength, because the cropping shears that they used weighed 40 pounds or more. And they basically their jobs were being threatened by these new machines, which were called shearing frames, which basically did the job automatically. It could be operated by, one man and a boy doing the work of 10 men. All right. Well, I won't tell much more of the story, but the crucial thing you need to know about who the Luddites were is that the way that word is used, in the modern day, and actually this only started around the 1950s, in fact, is used, often as somebody who either doesn't like new technology in general, or is not very good at, working with new technology. And that is absolutely not what the Luddites were about, and it's is a history written by the victors, the idea that they were against technology as such. Absolutely not. They were against the particular machines that were, displacing their jobs, and so when they went into the factories with, with their big hammers and smashed those machines, they only smashed those particular machines. They left the other machines alone. There was a slogan of the Yorkshire Luddites, which was that they would put down machinery hurtful to commonality. Well, what does that mean, commonality? Well, it's kind of means generally the common good, but also at that time that word was also used for just the common people as opposed to the gentry. But it also has resonances to do with the whole sort of system of rural life up till the middle of the 18th century, of basically people subsisting by being able to use the common land, graze their animals on the common land, gather firewood and forage for food on the common land, which was being basically was that whole system was being destroyed by the process of the enclosures, which was basically the privatisation and enclosure of the common land. And that was where that process was at its height in 1812. So the Luddites were not and are not people who are opposed to technology and think technology is a bad thing, or they think progress is a bad thing. I want to go back to the past or something like that. It's about opposing technology that basically is being introduced in, I mean, primarily in the interests of the owners of that technology, and in order to control people as part of the whole process of capitalism. And we'll talk a lot more about that. So, I mean, that's the crucial thing. about you need to remember about the Luddites. Basically, there was a big uprising. Lots of machines got smashed. Eventually, the authorities suppressed it by basically had the whole of the north of England was pretty much under military occupation. There were actually more troops, trying to control the Luddites than were actually fighting Napoleon at that point. 50 or so people across Lancashire and Yorkshire and Nottinghamshire were hanged. Lots more were transported to Australia. And that broke the resistance, really. But that tactic and more than the tactic, strategy of machine breaking didn't end with the Luddites. Another famous case in Britain was in the 1830s, where in the south of England, agricultural labourers broke lots of threshing machines, which was taking away their work in the winter time, and that was a very actually incredibly successful uprising that delayed the introduction of threshing machines for maybe 20, 30 years. And so machine breaking has happened in lots of other places in other times as industrialism has come in. The syndicalists in the early 20th century did quite a fair bit of it. And for me, I mean, what's important about the Luddites is that what they did actually focus on machines. There's been everybody was telling them, oh no, it's just what you have to fight, and this is what Marxists have has always been the line from Marxists, the problem is not the machines as such, it's the whole system of capitalism and that set of social structures. And there's nothing actually, it's not the machines that you need to worry about. And I think what's really important is that they actually said, no, actually, it's the machines that are the problem. There's actually an issue with the machines as such. So that kind of leads me on to something I wanted to do now, which is to just sort of explore some sort of basic issues in the politics of science and technology. Traditionally, we are told technology is neutral. Technology is not political, hasn't got any values sort of embedded in it. That's one traditional idea that we're given. And there's a whole ideology around technology, which is actually, I think, very central to capitalism, that basically technology, new technology, more technology equals progress. Very central ideology and one that needs to be thought about, really. So what I've done is I've got some questions here. If you pass these bits of paper around, I'll give you some of those. And there's questions at the top there, and for about several or 8 minutes, I think we'll do, maybe a fraction longer. Maybe can you get into groups of how many we've got? 4, 10 altogether. Right, 11. All right, so let's do. Let's have 2 groups of 4, 1 group of 3. So okay, how about you 3 guys? 1, 2, 3, 4. And I'll go with these 4, 3 at the end here, yeah? So have a talk about those questions at the top there. Remember to let everybody have their say. All right, well, let's just have a little bit of feedback from that. Just on the first question, which is really the kind of most fundamental thing, what do people think about that issue? Do we think that technology is kind of neutral and, well, it just depends on, you can use it for, depends on how it's used, or does it depend on who controls it? Or is there actually something inherent in technology that can actually yeah, be good or bad.
It just depended on the context, because there were things like certain kind of bombs and weapons and all the rest of it that can only be used destructively. On the other hand, you might have something like a defibrillator that by and large would only be used in a good way, but then there's a whole lot of other things that depends on the context.
Okay. Yeah.
Facebook, double-edged sword. Good for organising protests, also good for surveillance.
Okay, if you think about, computers and the internet,
I think we kind of came to the conclusion that it wasn't neutral, and that we were just talking about how technology kind of arises out of certain social conditions and reinforces those social conditions, and it's kind of just that idea, so we played around with that idea and tried to think about that.
Yeah, in a system which is already capitalist and hyper-stratified, whether that's contemporary society, whether that's the early part of the 19th century, technology will be politicised because people who have access to capital have access to technology. So the technology may be neutral, but the circumstances in which it is developed will inevitably benefit those people who already have access to pre-existing sources of capital.
Any thoughts from over here? I heard it before, but they didn't.
Yeah. I think that technology is usually neutral, except in examples. We gave it earlier about weapons and stuff that's come out of the military, but then on the flip side, you've got the space program that was insanely expensive and no one else could have done it. So, just depends.
I'm not sure that's factually right. I mean, the US space program, I mean, obviously there were links with the military, but it was basically funded as a civilian program, as remember.
Right, but a lot of the technology came out of the military.
Absolutely. All right, well, I think we could kind of spend a lot of time on these, you know, keeping on with that discussion. I'll just summarise, the bit of the way that, I'll first of all talk about what's on the bottom of this thing, which is, basically this question about, you know, the relationship between science and technology and society and capitalism is a very political question, and one that has been, debated both, in politics and in academia. And broadly speaking, the standard liberal view is basically science and technology develops all on its own, according to its own internal dynamic. It's this boffin in a lab somewhere has a brilliant idea, gee whiz, we get this fantastic new gadget. That's the kind of and society and capitalism basically don't really influence how science and technology develops. Sometimes liberals are willing to admit that science and technology does, once it's arrived, does then affect how society works. And so, for example, there's an awful lot of talk about, at the moment, that we're in an information society or a network society is the buzzword. But there isn't much, they don't tend to have to say much about the way society affects technology. They see it as a kind of one-way thing going to the right there. In the 80s and 90s, we got a movement of postmodernists who actually kind of went to a rather the opposite other extreme and said basically science is just a social text, it doesn't have any more claims to truth than any other text, there is no absolute truth is relative, this is a bit of a caricature, but I think it's not so far off what a lot of postmodernists would agree with. And in my view, that's that overstates the problem. What I'm going to be talking about a lot is the way in which science and technology is affected by social forces. But I used to be a biologist, and to say that there is no such thing as scientific truth, that scientific truth is no better than any other truth, is really overdoing things, in my view. I think the most accurate way of portraying it is the fourth one there, that the influence flows in both directions. The two things are kind of semi-autonomous. There's a lot of influence going backwards and forwards, but to reduce your understanding down to, it's only, the influence only goes one way or the other way, it is not helpful. I'll just mention that I think a lot of Marxists have tended to side with the liberals on these issues, because Marxism has tended to be very heavily invested in the idea of science as progress. Marx himself, was a great believer in that. The capitalism and the industrial capitalism and the creation of the way that this liberated the forces of production is a great step forward for humanity. Capitalism is a progressive stage in history, is the traditional Marxist understanding. So they've tended often to, be more actually rigidly believing in technology as progress than even some of the liberals. I can see we're getting behind time. I want to just talk momentarily about the idea of technocracy, which I think is really one of the best ways to think about this. So technocracy simply is, simple definition of it would be that the way power is exerted through technology. It's a way of controlling both nature and people and the society through technology. And that's what, in essence, the Luddites were facing with the Industrial Revolution. It was the use of these new technologies to, totally restructure the whole economy and thereby, restructure their communities, their whole economic basis of life, through technology. That kind of way of trying to exert power through technology actually goes back earlier than the Industrial Revolution. It comes actually from the Scientific Revolution of the 17th century, about 200 years before the Industrial Revolution, where you had a whole series of philosophers, a key one of which would be a guy called Francis Bacon, writing about the need for the new scientific method, and the job of science basically being to control nature. That is the basic concept that has been very dominant in our society, ever since that period. You had a shift from, I'm being very caricatured here, but older ways of thinking about nature as alive, as a living organism, to thinking of nature as a machine, a mechanism, as resources to be exploited and used, the forces of nature to be harnessed for human benefit. And that is what I would describe as the fundamentally sort of technocratic ideology that has been very central to our society in the last 100 years, and which is very much associated with the idea of progress, that the more we can control nature, that must be progress. And of course, I'm not saying that's wrong, that we shouldn't try to control nature at all. But there, as lots of people, sociologists and philosophers have pointed out, it's that attitude of control and domination which has been very destructive in many ways. which we'll come on to in a minute. But okay, so the way I've been sort of beginning to think over the last few years is basically that you have on the one hand capitalism as an economic and a class system, and you have technocracy as a separate and independent force, which very much interacts with capitalism all the time, but is not, you know, reducible to just another aspect of capitalism. It has its own dynamic. There is no doubt that one of the ways in which science and technology developed is through its own internal, you know, discovery of new pieces of information and application of those new pieces of information about nature, independent of what capitalists want to do with that. So it's sort of partially independent, but it's also very, very linked, I think. One of the big problems about this whole technocratic approach to the world, which has become more and more dominant in the 20th century, and the development of systems, basically, the idea of organising life according to very well-regulated and smoothly functioning systems. This came in with particularly a guy called Frederick Taylor, who you may have heard of, who developed the whole system of the Fordist factory of making jobs, making everybody's job on the production line very, very precisely described, you know, and very mechanical, very little... independent use of skills and thinking for the worker.
Technology give it, in some cases, the opportunity to roll that back? That one of the problems with industrialisation was people who were, say, taken out of their homes and used to do craft and stuff in their own organic kind of space, and they were in a factory and you had to come at a certain time or in a mine and you had to endure that. And the thing about this new technology is that, again, it changes the way we work. And for some people, it actually allows them maybe to work from home, to control the hours they work, those kind of things.
Yeah, I mean, we're in fact just about to do what's often called a workers' inquiry around all those things. And some people do feel liberated by working at home, but... A lot of home workers will tell you that actually they are still very much caught up in a system that is...
Absolutely, I have no problem with that. But yeah. I think in some ways it does allow a certain kind of flexibility in all kinds of things that we didn't have flexibility before.
And that's what's often called nowadays post-Fordism. Whether it is actually really post-Fordism or actually just an extension of Fordism is an interesting question, which I don't think we can get into here. So development of a kind of systems approach to the world. And so in the middle of the 20th century, you get the science of cybernetics, which is basically the control of complex systems through mathematical models and so on, feedbacks and... and that, of course, gave its name to cyberspace. And so you have this technocratic systems-based approach to life. Frederick Taylor said, in the past, the man was first, in the future, the system must be first. One of the problems of a technocratic approach is that, the technocrats, who are generally scientists and engineers, tend to see the world through the lens of science and technology, basically. And they tend to frame issues and frame problems in ways that make them amenable to science and scientific and technological change. So scientific and technological solutions. So classic example is, you probably all have heard the argument about genetic modification and will it help us to feed the hungry people in the third world, it'll increase crop productivity, there'll be more food. Okay, that is a classic technocratic way of thinking about the problem. It assumes that the basic assumption is that the reason lots of people are hungry in the world is because there's not enough food. In fact, that's simply incorrect. There's plenty of food. The problem is distribution. People don't have the money to buy that food. They're poor. They're poor because of a set of, you know, economic and social structures that, you know, enforce them being in poverty. So what you get with this technocratic approach is a misframing of the problem, which then produces a solution that is supposedly a non-political. Feed the world, isn't it lovely? Who can object to that? That's not political, right? But actually, it's very political, because it, you know, what it always does is, I mean, in the case of GM crops, it says, look, you know, we want to feed the world. We're nice people, and so we're going to produce this this lovely new GM seed that you can sow on your farm. It'll boost your crop yields. And by the way, you do have to use more fertilizer with it. We own the seed, so you can't take the seeds from your crop and sow them the next year. But it, you know, you'll get more food and everything will be nice. You know, and so, yeah, that's basically a technocratic approach. Always, in the end, produces more technology that corporations can sell. That's one of the things it does. It produces what we call, what are often called techno fixes. That's to say, you have a problem. Technocrats think, let's find a techno fix for this. Okay, so a technological fix for it. Now, where we are at the moment, we're facing a really major crisis, a crisis that I think is basically caused very largely, I mean, I'm talking about the environmental resource crisis, global warming, you know, biodiversity collapse, and of course the economic crisis that we're facing, which is a bit more complex. But again, faced with this, you know, this dire situation, which basically has been caused by 200 years of industrial capitalism, of burning fossil fuels, of basically thinking of the environment in that sort of technocratic way as just another resource to be exploited rather than something that you have some kind of relationship with. We've got a crisis that really, you know, I mean, I think it's the whole future of civilization. I don't think is an overstatement. If we get runaway global warming, and what are being proposed in response to this this crisis of industrial capitalism, rather than going back and looking at the real causes of, you know, of these environmental problems, is another classic techno fix. There's a couple of them. One is synthetic biology, which I don't know, have people heard of synthetic biology? It's a kind of it's basically an extreme form of genetic engineering. Where they're talking about not merely tinkering around one or two genes, but literally designing organisms completely from scratch, synthesizing their DNA in the laboratory, and then so designing them completely from scratch to suit our needs. One particular way in which they're talking about it is producing biofuels from things like algae, for example. But also manipulating crop plants so they can produce more fibres and general biomass for burning, basically, in order to and that's supposed to be a solution to the climate change problem, because it's supposed to be carbon neutral. That's a classic it's a classic techno fix that, I mean, is not confined to synthetic biology. This idea of biofuels has been, you know, been going on now for the last 15 or 20 years. There's a bunch of problems that it's already caused in third world countries. But I won't go and talk a lot about that. What I want to just mention, because it's a campaign that we are trying to get started, is this is the idea of geoengineering. Which is basically We can, the idea is, okay, oh dear, the climate's heating up. We have to engineer the climate system of the whole planet to cool it back down again. My colleague Helen has deserted me. She was going to do the geoengineering bit, so I'm just going to have to tell you a very small amount about that, because time's getting on. Okay, so they want to basically try to engineer the climate system of the whole planet. How they're going to do that? There's various ideas that are being out there. Generally, they fall into what they call solar radiation management. That's to say, basically, trying to make more sunlight reflect off the planet rather than being captured in the atmosphere, because that's what greenhouse gases do, basically. They trap heat from the sun in the atmosphere. So the idea is to manipulate the atmosphere so that in various ways, for example, trying to make clouds more reflective to sunlight. So the idea is the sunlight bounce off the top of the clouds back into space, the planet will cool down. Another example of that is they want to blast massive amounts of sulfite particles into the upper atmosphere, which will supposedly stay up there, reflect sunlight, create a kind of sunshade over the whole planet. At one point they were even seriously talking about launching vast mirrors out into space to literally reflect sun.
What if they face the wrong way and reflect it back in?
They're not. I think that's been kind of abandoned, that idea now. And the other idea, the other main idea is, trying to capture more carbon from the atmosphere and keep it out of the atmosphere. So one thing that's been talked about quite a lot is ocean fertilisation, and also trying to manipulate the pH of the ocean, the acid base balance, whether it's more acid or alkaline.
So it holds them to the ground and put carbon in there, doesn't it?
That's not geoengineering, that's carbon sequestration.
People often include carbon.
They're both
technical. people sometimes. You're thinking of the idea of biochar,
there are two different ways of carbon sequestration.
Yeah, I mean there are a bunch of different ways.
What
I was just going to mention is these ocean-based methods. The idea: dump loads of calcium carbonate into the oceans of the whole planet. Which, if you think of the scale of that, is just quite an extraordinary concept. In order to change the pH by a few hundredths of a whatever, which will allow the oceans to absorb more carbon dioxide. Another idea is you fertilise the ocean with iron filings. This allows algae to grow. They soak up lots of carbon dioxide. The algae sit to the bottom of the ocean. You've solved your problem, supposedly. A lot of these ideas are basically wacky, but they are, and a lot of them, there doesn't seem to be a great deal of evidence that any of them will work, but what they serve as is a very effective way of, not dealing with the problem. If we think, they have a very nice way of saying it, this is plan B, they say, yes, of course we want to reduce carbon emissions, but, just in case we can't manage it, this is plan B, if there's no other solution. The trouble with that, of course, is that plan B undermines the willingness to undertake plan A. Someone like Richard Branson actually said out loud in public, if we can find a geoengineering solution to the problem, then everything would be fine. We wouldn't need the Copenhagen climate summit, and we could just go on flying our trains and driving our cars. Of course, it's not hard to see his own financial interest in flying planes. He doesn't see this as a problem. I won't go, because we're short of time, I won't talk a lot more about geoengineering, except to say that basically a lot of the forces that are behind the climate denialism, the idea that the global warming isn't happening, are exactly the same forces that are now slightly switching to advocate geoengineering. So, for example, the big oil companies, the neoconservative think tanks, particularly in the United States. Yeah, people like these, tycoons like Bill Gates and Richard Branson, the scientificists.
They're
a difference.
They're going to the moon, aren't they?
And a lot of Western governments are now being more and more persuaded. The British Royal Society, our great scientific establishment, produced a report in 2008, I think it was, saying this is a way forward that we mustn't ignore, kind of thing. The UK is really actually rather central in the international push for geoengineering. In fact, that was.
So who's organising against it?
Exactly. This is why I raised this particular subject, is because at the moment there hasn't yet been a response either from the Green Movement or from the anarchist movement, and we're trying to basically get that together. At the moment it's largely about largely at talking stages, although there have been some small-scale trials done around the world, for example, of ocean fertilisation. There was a plan in the UK to start this, do the preliminary stages of a system for cloud whitening, which collapsed because the scientist and one of the consultants to the project had lodged a patent on the process. So they got into a fight about it. It was called the SPICE project. It collapsed a couple of years ago. They'll be back. So we're trying to bring people together around that. So
is there a flyer or something with information?
Over here, there's a couple of briefings on geoengineering over here. One is from the international campaign called Hands Off Mother Earth, and there's a more detailed briefing there. I know. Well, I think we're supposed to stop at 12, and I've got 6
10
minutes.
12.
What? Oh my goodness! Really? Is it supposed to? Oh, I didn't realise there's supposed to be a 10-minute break.
Oh, okay.
To get from place to place.
All right. Well, listen. I'm sorry, it's because I wanted now for us to have a bit of a discussion about that, can I just say, if you're interested either in geoengineering or the other project that we're doing, is for next year, we're pulling together a gathering in May next year of all kinds of different groups around politics and technology, whether it's anti-nuclear, GM, gender politics in relation to technology, basically everything you can think of. There's a technological issue in there somewhere. We're trying to bring together a load of groups in that gathering, and there's some leaflets about that over there, or maybe I've got them. So if you're interested in that, just leave me your email, or likewise if you're interested in helping out around geoengineering, just come and see
me.
You've
got a stall in the book fair as well?
We don't actually know. Some of this stuff is going to go onto the Corporate Watch store, so it'll be there later. But the leaflets are basically free. It's a leaflet about the gathering and the about geoengineering, and a kind of general one about the history of the lab arts, if you're interested in that. I'm sorry, I didn't realise I was supposed to. I will be. Okay. All right. Well, I'll catch you later. Great.
Thank you.
Okay. Anybody who can stay around now, we can talk for a few minutes. Yeah, go on.
You said that you thought the kind of origins of this crisis go back 200 years. It appears to me they actually go back a lot further. I think it goes back to agriculture, empire. It kind of seems to go back, you know, thousands of years, 8,000 years, 10,000 years, who knows. And the kind of climate change started back then as well. It was a mass kind of deforestation, burning stuff down, wiping out the megafauna, you know. We actually started changing the climate a long time ago, so we're clearly in the Anthropocene now, but when it started is debatable. Yeah, it might have started 200 years ago, it might have started 10,000 years ago. In terms of how, I think the question, I mean, generally, in terms of geoengineering, I totally agree with you. I think it's really dangerous, it's the wrong direction. We should be doing, we should be radically changing our relationship with the planet. We need to kind of reforest the planet. We need to totally change the nature of our society. And I think hierarchy is probably the primary problem in terms of the nature of our society. In, with geoengineering, though, I mean, the thing that worries me is, I don't know if you followed the work of David Spratt, the guy from Climate Code Red in Australia. But, okay, so he's done an awful lot of stuff on the climate. And his concern is that we're actually at the early stage of runaway climate change now. And it's basically, the stark options are going to be really runaway climate change, wiping out most life on Earth, if not all, or geoengineering. And we might actually,
Yeah, people say that. I mean, some people in the climate movement do say that. I mean, I don't think we are quite at that point yet, and I think it's...
How do we know?
Of course, it's hard to know, but I mean, I think any of the, you know, the geoengineering ideas that I've seen are, you know, likely to make things actually much worse, really. You know, if you're talking about tinkering with the, you know, the climate system of the entire planet, about which we understand so little, you know, think about what the impacts that's going to have, could potentially have, and you only better to get one shot at it. You know, if you get it wrong, you're fucked. I understand people's genuine kind of worry about that, but I think, I think we at least for a few years we have to act seriously as if we can, you know. We put a priority on reducing carbon emissions. As for that general thing about where did all the problems start, well, yeah, I mean, that's a massive question. All I'd say is that I think the Industrial Revolution was a kind of step change that, you know, yes, there were lots of environmental problems before that, but, you know, what happened with the Industrial Revolution was so significant, took the whole thing to a really new level.
I think actually the sort of difference is like we were making massive difference before, but they were always localised, so like megafauna and stuff, like in that area we killed off all the big cats or something, whereas now we're actually affecting the entire world, and that's the big difference.
Yes, that's certainly one big difference. Any other thoughts?
I think when you like started off saying that we've got sort of essentially four different enormous crises, like biodiversity, etc. as well, I think the problem is the technology tends to sort of, if you solve a problem with technology, you look at one symptom and you go, we can fix this with this specific technology, whereas what you need to do is find the root of the problem and fix that. And I think that's one of the biggest issues.
Yeah, absolutely. I think people are probably about to want to come in and see you for the next meeting. Just take a look at what everything's here. The leaflets are free. If you're interested in finding out about our gathering next year, or in particularly in geoengineering, or just in kind of being on our list, then just give me your email address.